The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. Whatever stage your business is at, there's always time to imagine sustainable, positive change. AIB, for the life you're after.
But our first guest is a Kerry man in the process of building up his second company. He was on with us nearly 10 years ago when he was scaling his Carlow-based security enterprise Netwatch in the US. Since then, life and work have taken him down some very different paths. David Walsh, as I said there, it's your second time on the show. We don't normally have people back on twice, but a lot has happened in the last number of years for you. On a personal level, you lost your wife, Beatrice.
Yeah, Beatrice passed away 3 years ago after a very brave, dignified battle with a very rare cancer called leiomyosarcoma. It's so rare, it only affects 6 in a million people, predominantly women. And after the first round of chemotherapy, at the age of 52, we were told that Beatrice had only 4 weeks to live. And I will never forget her reaction. It wasn't anger. It wasn't fear of passing away. She had made her peace with God. It wasn't even self-pity in terms of missing out on family events. It was concern. Concern for other women. The first question she asked after she heard the news was, how can we prevent this from happening to another woman? So we set up a foundation called the Beatrice Pembroke Walsh Foundation. And it has two objectives. One is to build awareness predominantly with the GP community, so there'd be earlier diagnosis of this rare illness. And secondly, to fund research so that one day we will have a cure for this very deadly cancer.
And she was very strong. She hung on a lot longer than that initial prognosis, didn't she?
Yeah, Beatrice was mentally very, very strong. Of course, she was an entrepreneur herself long before I was. But I remember when the doctor left the room, she said, look, I accept the will of God, but I don't accept the doctor's prognosis in terms of time. He said, we've a lot to do. God will give us time to do those things. All we need is faith. And she was right. We got 12 months more than the most optimistic medical opinion.
What was she like?
She was an amazing woman. She was incredibly strong. As I said, she was an entrepreneur. She had a company called Creative Design, which she started when she was, she's from Kerry originally, like myself. But when we moved to Carlow, she brought the business there. It was very, very successful. But when our three children were born, Patrick, Clodagh and Christopher, she made the very brave choice that a lot of women make in terms of changing their career or stepping away from a business to be a full-time stay-at-home mom. And although she moved away from her business, she didn't move away from leadership. She stepped into a new leadership role based on a grounded in family, the local community where we live, and helping others. And there's no doubt, but my entrepreneurial journey, my journey as CEO of Netwatch, was the greatest beneficiary of her leadership. I had my own in-house mentor.
So she was a very good sounding board for you on business stuff as well.
I've lost count of the number of times I came home with my shoulders drooping, a business challenge laying heavily on my mind. And after a discussion with Beatrice, went back to work the following day with a spring in my step and a solution to a problem I thought was insurmountable. She was just extraordinary. She was so mentally strong. When she got that bad news that she only had 4 weeks to live, when it all calmed down, she said, can I record an album? Because she was a magnificent singer. And she wanted to leave her voice on an album for our children. And from her hospital bed in ICU, she recorded an album.
And she must have been in a weakened state, a very emotional state at that time.
She was, but as I said, she was so mentally strong. She was a woman of real deep faith, and that was hugely important to her. But her album is on Spotify, and she called it From Rad to Trad, from radiology to traditional music.
So she must have been somebody who was able to stare in the face of challenges and bad news and have a sense of humour when she needed to as well.
She was an inspiration to us all. She really was.
So where did the two of you meet?
We're both from Kerry, and we met in O'Flaherty's pub in Dingle on the August bank holiday weekend 1992. And we got married 6 years later on the exact same day. And we have three wonderful children. Thankfully, they've all got their mother's brains and her good looks. So they're doing very well. They're all in college, or finished college now. They all studied engineering like Mom. Beatrice studied industrial design in what is now SETU in Carlow. And ironically, I was in Carlow at the time and we didn't meet, but we met in Dingle, in Flaherty's pub, and it took off from there. And we were together for 30 years, married for 25, and had a wonderful journey.
when you started on your work career, because in the early days you worked in Keenan's, the animal feeds place and ag feeds place, would you have known her at that time?
That's when we met in 1992. And interestingly enough, so again, going back to her mental strength and her entrepreneurial flair, she had given up her business before I left Keenan's. And then I come home one Friday evening and I said to her, I'm going to leave Keenan's and set up my own business, not knowing if it was going to be a success or not. And I described what we were going to do with Netwatch. And the only thing she said to me was, go for it. I believe in you. You can make this work. And that was the support she gave me. And that never faded until the day she died.
And that was what you needed to hear. And that's what she said to you. And how did you get started off in your own career with Keenan's in Carlow? And what was the first job you had there?
I studied agricultural science in UCD. And that's what brought me to Carlow. Keenan's was based in this beautiful, picturesque village of Burris at the foot of Mount Leinster. And here was this amazing company, a global leader all over the world. And every market that it went to, they dominated. They were iconic. And my thinking, going to Keenan's first, that I'd go in there for 6 months and get some experience, because when you've no experience, you think 6 months is a lot. But of course it's not. My first job was actually a technical job, rations together for farmers, helping them how to use the Keenan feeder, which was used to mix forages and feedstuffs, concentrates together to feed cows, sheep, beef cattle. But on the very early days, Gerard Keenan, who was CEO, said to me, look, you have a personality that could match sales. You could be a very good salesman. And I had a very jaundiced view of sales, because going through UCD, we were almost led to believe that all salesmen were like snake oil salesmen or anti-wrinkle cream people selling. And I remember even the Farmers Journal at the time used to have this slogan, fearlessly on the farmer's side, as if the rest of us weren't.
So he reckoned you'd be able to part these farmers with their money, basically, which is not easy.
No, he thought I could help them by selling them a Keenan feeder. And there was a guy there called Louis Carney, a great friend of mine, and he passed away since during COVID. But he was convinced. He was the top salesman in the place. And he said to me, David, if you go into sales, I'll take you under my wing and I'll train you. And he did. And I became the top salesman in the company. And then I went off to sales management, and then I went on to become the managing director.
And then you were managing director, yeah.
Of the Irish market.
And it was at that time that you got the idea for the Netwatch security business. How did that come about?
It was, I think, about June 2002. And we're out for a meal, myself and the co-founder of Netwatch, Niall Kelly. And a friend of ours at the meal was explaining a situation during the week, how he was attacked, responding to a traditional burglar alarm at his place of work. He was the key holder. The site had a serious history of false alarms, and the neighbours were always given out when the siren went off. So he raced to the site just to put in the code to stop the bells and whistles. And he got attacked. And we just felt that there had to be a better way. And you have to understand, in June 2002, there was no internet like we know it now, no broadband, no Wi-Fi. There was no digital recording in relation to cameras. It was all VHS tapes. But Niall Kelly had discovered a company in Australia that specialised in video transmission technology for military installations. So we flew to Melbourne, met them, they described what they were doing. And our thinking in the start was that you would have a system where you could log on to the cameras, albeit it might take a few minutes, just to make sure the coast was clear if the burglar alarm went off. And over there, they explained you could do it in the opposite direction. You could get the cameras to send you an image, a photograph, if somebody entered.
Something changed.
So it was absolutely, and it was proactive. And then as we were leaving the boardroom, the technical guy said, you can incorporate an audio challenge. That's what I mean. You get a photograph with somebody in a red jacket or a blue hoodie, then you can challenge them with an audio warning. You in the blue hoodie, leave the area immediately. This is private property, and so on and so forth. So it was all about crime prevention as opposed to crime detection. So we came home, packed in our jobs and started. And in truth, because of Keenan's, we had a global vision from day one.
And the US then became a big part of that business and a big opportunity for you.
I always felt that there needs to be alignment between the culture of an organisation and the markets in which they go into. And when you start a company, you have a choice of strategically positioning in two ways to be successful. One, you can go for a high value proposition where you develop a very close, intimate relationship with your customers, or you can go the other way and have a very cost efficient system where price is the most important issue. We were in the premium side, and I just felt that the US market, albeit that there's 50 different countries there in reality, that the natural culture is one of high quality service and price comes after it. And that's what happened.
And the company had grown and you had lots of customers in international markets and everything. You could have floated, could you, on IPO'd it on the stock market? You decided not to do that.
We looked at IPOs, actually. I did with the Irish Stock Exchange, I did a program with them back in the day. But we decided that we wanted to keep control of the organisation ourselves. And as we grew in America, we grew from direct selling at the very start onto working with strategic partners, onto acquiring two companies over there. And we brought in a private equity company in 2018 to acquire those companies. That's the route we went, as opposed to going through an IPO.
And then a majority shareholding was bought out. You're still a shareholder in the company?
Niall and I still own about 20% of the company. We still attend board meetings and contribute to the overall strategy.
Was it hard for you to give up majority shareholding and all the control that goes with that?
I think as entrepreneurs, we get mature with age in terms of our thinking. There was a time when there was no way. We felt we had to have 100% and that was it. But, you know, having a slice of a big pizza is better than having a small donut of your own. So we decided to bring them in. And the timing was right. It was really right because we were growing rapidly. There was a great valuation put on Netwatch at the time because of our growth strategy, because of our technology, because of our team. So the timing was right.
And the business has changed quite a lot. One of the areas that has become big is monitoring legal cannabis growing in the US. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so cannabis was being legalised in certain states for medicinal purposes. So there was very, very strict regulations in terms of getting licences, and one of them was security. And we were the very first to get in Massachusetts with the licensing authority there, and then it became the standard. They set Netwatch or Netwatch equivalent as a standard for anybody in the medicinal cannabis industry.
So as more states legalised it then, that was more business.
They just replicated the legal principles.
So the cannabis wasn't the only thing that was growing.
No, we grew very well with them, and it's still a huge part of our business.
And I'd imagine, given that it's such a valuable thing, it's wide open, is it, for theft?
And again, there was two rules that they had. You had to have a cultivation plant separate to a dispensary, so two different places, and both of them needed security. And obviously the dispensary, where the final product was, were under threat of being attacked for...
Would you get many break-ins or attempts?
Well, over the years, we've prevented hundreds and hundreds of attempted break-ins across all those plants.
And the other thing that's changed, the technology has moved on now, and it's got smaller, it's got more sophisticated. How does that affect what Netwatch does?
It affects it in a very positive way, in that we've embraced AI long, long before anybody else did. We're using AI in Netwatch for almost 10 years. In terms of driving efficiencies in the organisation, in terms of using it to distinguish whether somebody on site is actually a good person or a bad person. We can tell by their gait. Everybody has a natural gait. It's as unique as your fingerprint.
So how would you do that? You have human eyes, maybe in Carlow, on a particular site that's somewhere in Europe or wherever, but the technology can help that person to identify.
The technology is sitting in the background learning all the time on the decisions that the human made. And if somebody turned out to be just an owner, just going in to collect something, as opposed to somebody trying to break into it, it learns their natural behaviour, it learns how they walk, it learns their gait, and it makes it far more accurate in terms of responding to real events as opposed to false positives.
So when somebody looks like they might be attempting to break in, or they are, somebody in Carlow can give them a direction to say, back off, you and the blue hoodie, whatever it is, you get out of here. But the AI is getting to a point where it's able to identify certain characteristics. Is what kind of things?
The way somebody walks, the speed they walk, their gait, all that type of stuff. And it's building its intelligence on all the information that it got from tens of thousands of cameras around the world.
And what about different languages around the world? If you somebody in Ireland telling somebody to get out of there, and that person is in a factory site in South Africa or wherever, how can they communicate?
The great thing with the AI that we've developed ourselves with our own in-house team is that we can give an audio warning from Carlo in English, and it can go out in South Africa in Swahili or French in Paris or wherever happens to be the case. You can even get it down to having somebody with a Kerry accent doing it. That's where technology is going.
You've tested it, have you?
We've tested it.
And you decided then, as you'd backed away from Netwatch and you're still a shareholder in it, that you'd set up this this new company, which is about using technology again to monitor people in their homes, Halo Care.
I stayed on board after the transaction with Riverside until December 19. And then the plan was that myself and Beatrice, my wife, would go around the world and take time, take a year off. And then we all know what happened. COVID broke out. And we all saw firsthand the devastating impact that it had on the elderly population, particularly those in nursing homes. But there was a cohort of elderly people that were sort of ignored. These are people living alone in their own homes. They were forced to cocoon. Friends couldn't visit, family couldn't visit. It was a very lonely time for them. And we know that there's a huge correlation between loneliness and physical health, not just mental health. In addition to that, I think the vast majority of us would like to age in our own homes if we could do so. So we decided that we'd come up with Halo Care, put technology into the homes of elderly people to support them to live independently, quality lives in their own homes. There's been technology around for years to detect emergencies. Somebody would wear a pendant, and if they fell, it would trigger into a monitor centre, or they could press a panic button. And that all worked, I'm not saying it didn't, but to varying degrees of effectiveness, there was a lot of false alarms, false positives. So the technology we use is predominantly contactless technology. So a device fits in the wall, it's wireless, it's radar based, it recognises a human being, it recognises a horizontal image from a vertical image, so we know for certain that somebody's on the ground. But the great thing about it, it's working in the background. So the elderly person just lives a normal life.
And they'd have a device in each room, is it?
They'd have a device in each room. And the really exciting part is that that same device is proactive. It's learning the normal behaviour of Richard in the house, and it's raising red flags if something goes outside the normal behaviour.
So I was going to say, what happens if something doesn't look right to the machine? It's not necessarily monitored by people or staff the way Netwatch would be. It's automated. So what happens then when something...
We have a care hub in Carlow, a monitor centre, we call it a care hub, where we have nurses and care staff, 365 round the clock. And again, if something happens outside, if there's an emergency, like a fall or somebody strays from the house that has dementia, we know it in seconds. And then the nurses and care staff follow pre-agreed protocols as to who we ring, what we do and so on and so forth.
So if something doesn't look right with the technology, it alerts the person back in the care home and says there could be something here, and then they can go and look at that.
That's reactively, and that's exactly what happens. But proactively, it learns the normal behaviour of the person in the home. It learns how long they sit watching television on the couch each day, and let's say it's 2 hours and now it's gone to 5 hours, we'll get a red flag. That might mean the person is less motivated, they might have had an injury or whatever happens to be the case. It learns the number of steps that people take in the house each day, and let's say it's 4,500 steps and now it drops down to 1,500 steps. Well, that could be a sign that the person is injured. And we have all this really proactive information that we have that we can feed in to a proper care plan for the person.
Data protection must be absolutely crucial for something like that. It's vitally private information, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great point you make. We do not use cameras at all. It's all sensors that we use. Because, to your point, that the dignity, the privacy of the person in the house is most important. So we get the information that comes into us, and then we pass it on to the circle of care, be it the son, the daughter, be it to the local GP, be it to the community nurse. And the Irish healthcare system, like every healthcare system around the world, has serious challenges. We're living longer as a people, for starter. We're getting chronic illnesses earlier in life, so there's greater intervention. And there's a massive shortage in home care workers and healthcare workers. So I firmly believe, and we do, that technology has a huge role to play. It's not the panacea for everything, but if we can keep people out of hospitals, if we can keep people out of emergency departments, if we can keep people out of nursing homes, by using technology in the home that's supported by other home care workers, then that's the secret.
How do elderly people, David, feel about the idea of being monitored? It's not a camera, it's a device that detects movement. I'd imagine a lot of people would say, I'm not happy about that.
I think 5 years ago when we started, that was one of the first things, challenges we had to get over. But over the last 4 or 5 years, and particularly since COVID, you know, when we see the use of technology in a lot of different environments, the elderly people really have bought into it. Because one of the part of our solution in terms of keeping people connected is that we have an age-friendly tablet called the Halo Pad. So they can use this to do video calls with their circle of care, with their GP or whatever happens to be the case. They can use it for what we call cognitive stimulation. So they can do crosswords, they can do chess, they can play chess against the device or against their friends. They can play drafts and just keep them constantly stimulated. And it's so easy to use, and they love it because elderly people are they're very educated themselves. But in terms of using it, technology like that, it sort of scares them a bit. But with the age-friendly device, the Halo Pad, it's exceptional.
How far do you think this kind of medical technology can go, and the use of AI as well?
I think it's only starting the journey in terms of what it can do for medical applications. And already it's been used in assessing x-rays, CAT scans, all that sort of stuff, which is far faster and far probably more accurate than a human being. And it's going to keep moving in that direction. Like we use AI in HaloCare now predominantly for driving efficiencies to make sure that we're get rid of all the labour-intensive jobs. I was just mentioning to somebody this morning, obviously the industry that we're in is highly regulated and there are different policy documents for every single aspect of the business, which in the past could take somebody 3 years to write up. Now it can be done in 30 seconds. Just press a button.
When you mention about the security and NetWatch and how technology can identify characteristics and traits of movements of people and whether things look shifty or not, in the health area, do you think we'll reach a point where remotely technology will be able to do a lot of diagnosis for people?
Oh, I believe it will. And I believe there'll be a lot of interactions with, in inverted commas, digital assistants who will be able to speak to a person in the home and who can escalate the situation to a GP or a doctor or a clinician after a conversation. And of course, the great thing about AI, it remembers everything. You know, so if somebody has an ailment today and they're speaking to a digital assistant, it's all memorised. So when in 3 months' time, they can put it all together. So I think it's going to play a huge role in that.
You're very positive about those technological developments in AI and what it can do, and it's part of the businesses that you are involved in. But do you not feel that there has to be some brakes put on as well? Would you not be concerned about some of the downsides?
No, I think there has to be proper regulations in place, most definitely, and particularly around the point that you made in terms of privacy and GDPR and all that sort of stuff. I think it's really critical. But again, I'm a glass half full type of person, and I'm looking at the benefits, but the regulatory side has to match it.
Would you be fearful with all of this AI development that there won't be such a need for so many people to work, and that even in your own industry that there could be job losses in the future?
I'm not sure if there's going to be gross or net job losses. There will be changes in the behaviours of people. I think AI is going to take over the mundane tasks that we used to do in the past, writing documents and doing stuff like that, which will mean that there'll be more meaningful work. The mundane jobs will still have to be done, but they won't be done by a person. They'll be done by AI, and the people themselves will move into more meaningful roles.
We talked about Beatrice and how much she meant to you and the circumstances in which you lost her. How have you been since then? Do you think about her often, particularly? You might miss having her around for all kinds of things, including, as you said, a bit of business advice.
Yeah, look, it's difficult. There's no question about it. But I'm not looking for sympathy because thousands of people listening have gone through the same journey. But I will say this, losing your soulmate is like no other grief. And because it robs you not just of your partner, it robs you of your purpose, you know, and that takes time to manage. And it has to be endured. And over time, you learn to develop coping skills to be able to get through the day. And I have to say, 3 years later, it is getting easier. As a message of hope to anybody listening, it's very difficult in the start, but it does get easier in the context of managing. You're never going to forget them. You're never going to stop missing them. That is a natural thing. But our human nature is to develop strategies that will help us to cope. Like, the coming few days are going to be difficult because tomorrow night, for some oddball reason, I don't know why, I'm going to be receiving the Kerry Person of the Year 2025. I know the proudest person in the room, if she was there, would be Beatrice, because she was part of that story. Next Tuesday, we have our daughter's graduation from DCU. And again, that would be something that Beatrice would be very proud of, that her daughter followed her into studying engineering. And now she's graduating from biomedical engineering as Clodagh. So all these things take their toll. But as I said, we have no choice but to learn to cope.
You say you lose your purpose when something like that happens. In what way did that affect you?
Well, I've discovered since Beatrice went and this might sound very childish, that everything I've done in my life was to impress her. That's how close we were. Every single positive thing. And I compare it almost to the proverbial caveman. Yes, there was a thrill in the hunt, in hunting a deer or a stag or whatever happened to be the case, but the big prize was bringing it back to his partner to prove to her that he was the right person. I got great kicks of going to America and doing deals in large corporate boardrooms, but the real prize was coming home and telling Beatrice about it. And when you lose your soulmate like that, somebody that you know is on your side 1,000%, that's what I mean by purpose.
Well, I'm sure she'll be with you at those events that are coming up. We're going to play out with Beatrice, if that's okay, David. This is her singing Caledonia. And David Walsh, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Richard.
I don't know if you can see the changes that have come over me. In the last few days, I've been afraid I might drift away. I've been telling old stories, singing songs that makes me think about where I come from. And that's the reason why I seem so far away today. But let me tell you that I love you, and I think about you all the time. Caledonia, you're calling me. Now I'm going home. But if I shall become a stranger, though it would make me more than sad, Caledonia's been everything I've ever had.
The beautiful voice of Beatrice Pembroke Walsh there, recorded from her hospital bed.